Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 8, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we have the first call in our Legal Options for the New Administration series, and we will be discussing pending litigation and the new administration. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are pleased to have with us Stephen G. Bradbury, who is a partner at Deckert LLP, and William S. Consovoy, who is a partner at Consovoy McCarthy Park PLLC. I will turn it over to Will to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you both for speaking with us. Will, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much. And great to be here to talk about what is a interesting and timely topic. Steve and I are going to share the discussion here. I'm going to start by talking about how the administration can change positions or the considerations that go into that in the short term. And then Steve's going to talk more of a long-term view about the kinds of considerations that go into making big ticket changes in substantive areas of law. When you start thinking about the administration changing positions in cases, it's important to divide it up into the various procedural postures that might arise. And that's how I'd like to pursue the conversation. The first area you should think about, or anyone should think about, are cases in which the United States is a plaintiff. That happens more frequently than you might sometimes think, and it can happen in an array of areas of substantive law, both through the Department of Justice itself or also through the agencies. And I'd like to take on the department itself. What can the department do when it is the plaintiff in the case? One area where this comes up right now is in the area of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Since Shelby County, the Obama administration has been very aggressive in bringing Section 2 claims. Obviously, voter ID is one of the key areas, and one of the ongoing cases in that area is in the Fifth Circuit in the VC versus Abbott litigation. When the United States is a plaintiff, it has all the options that plaintiffs normally have, meaning it could abandon the litigation or it could settle the litigation on terms that are different than the previous administration might have settled that case. And as we're seeing, that is something that the Department of Justice may be considering in the voter ID litigation. In the district court, they sought a 30-day delay in order to reconsider and examine the case. That is normally the first step in changing positions. It doesn't guarantee that the administration is going to change its position on the case. It's going to take a thorough look at the issue and look at the institutional considerations that go into it. But that may be an area in which you may see some early action on this kind of change of position. One thing to keep in mind is there's nothing new about this. This is historically something that all administrations take into account as they come into office. And one example that we located, which I thought was fascinating, was what President Thomas Jefferson did after he defeated John Adams in the election of 1800. Obviously, the Sedition Act was a big issue then. As many on the phone might well know, President Jefferson abandoned all prosecutions under the Sedition Act after coming into office because of his belief that the statute was unconstitutional. So to the extent that there are questions raised about the Trump administration abandoning positions, it's hard to have a better historical pedigree than that one. So that's sort of the big picture view of what it looks like when the government is the plaintiff. I think that is the area where they have the most discretion, the most opportunity, because they're in almost complete control. Now, one way that private parties who support the litigation may try to impact that is through intervention. And that could arise both on the plaintiff side and on the defendant side. But in my experience, and I'd be curious to hear Steve's as well when he chimes in, it will be much easier for a plaintiff intervener to step into a case in the government's shoes than it will be for a defendant intervener, because ordinarily the interests that the person has as a plaintiff look more like the kinds of interests that Article III standing will permit than when they step in to defend the government when it has been sued by a private party. So that's it on the plaintiff side. On the defendant side, it's a little bit trickier because, again, the government is not in control. The best leverage the administration has when it's the defendant is making the decision whether to appeal an adverse ruling or simply accept that adverse ruling. So this also comes up fairly frequently. It has come up across administrations. One case you'd want to watch right now is the D.C. Circuit litigation over the Consumer Protection Financial Board. The CFPB has asked the D.C. Circuit for en banc review. The Justice Department filed a motion in December supporting the CFPB. If the D.C. Circuit declines to rehear the case, I would assume the CFPB will want to file a petition with the Supreme Court. The Attorney General can deny that permission, and that would be a way to keep the ruling in place where the Obama administration clearly was intent on pursuing an appeal. Another example to keep in mind there is the litigation involving Obamacare, U.S. House of Representatives versus Burwell. There, the district court granted summary judgment to the House on the issue there, of course, was a major standing question and then a more straightforward substantive question. HHS has appealed, but after the election, the House asked the D.C. Circuit to hold the case in abeyance so the administration could decide whether it wants to withdraw that appeal. The D.C. Circuit agreed and is holding the case until the end of February. So there's another example where the government, as a defendant, could abandon an appeal and leave in place a ruling favorable to the challengers. Again, there's nothing new here. One historic example from just recent history, the Bush administration lost a case in the D.C. Circuit called New Jersey versus EPA, in which it sought to deregulate mercury emissions for coal and oil-fired power plants. The Bush administration filed a cert petition, but after inauguration, the Obama EPA filed a motion to dismiss the cert petition, which the Supreme Court granted, leaving the D.C. Circuit ruling in place, which then allowed the Obama EPA to issue new regulations. Again, private parties who want the government to take these appeals or to offer a defense to an adverse ruling can try to intervene, but as we just learned in the CFPB litigation, that is much more difficult on the defendant's side. A group of states, nonprofits, and congressmen tried to intervene in that case. I think they see what's coming down the road, and the D.C. Circuit denied those motions without comment. So, again, taking one step back, the real advantage the government has on the defendant side is deciding to not appeal adverse rulings, but you need those rulings first, whereas on the plaintiff side, they can simply prevent those rulings from ever occurring in the first place by abandoning the litigation outright. Which I then takes us to the next issue, and I think this is where Steve's going to jump in and offer some thoughts, which is not how to handle cases, which is whether to keep a case, abandon a case, not appeal a case. That's one set of issues. But what happens when the government is in the middle of litigation and wants to actually alter the substantive position of the United States in a brief, whether it's at summary judgment in the district court or in the Court of Appeals, or even in the Supreme Court, that I think raises much trickier problems because now you're talking about actually having to tell a court that the United States is altering its view of the law. And with Steve, with that, I will hand it over to you to talk about that more.
Terrific. Will, thanks a lot. It's easy for the government, as Will has suggested, when you're talking about exercises of prosecutorial discretion, for example, to drop a prosecution, as Will has described, or where the government is a plaintiff in an enforcement action and perhaps has lost in the lower courts, and then for the new administration, which may disagree with the policy being pursued or the enforcement theory of enforcement, to simply drop it. But what I want to focus on is trickier situations where you're talking – mostly these come up in the context of a challenge to a federal program, an executive action. And the question is the government's interpretation of its own authority. And the big question facing a new administration, which is common at the beginning of a new change in party control of the White House, to make a decision, big picture policy decision, about whether to change the government's position in litigation in defending a program where the new administration may have a fundamentally different approach to the interpretation of the statute at issue and the government's own authority in a particular area. And here I really want to, I think, sound a note of caution, because there are long-term institutional interests that the executive branch has in how those decisions are made, how they play out in the courts. And it's probably best to think about these matters as like a large ocean liner, where what you're talking about is changing the direction in the course of the ocean liner. And that's a matter that, from the government's perspective, the executive branch's perspective, you're going to want to do it in a way that's durable and defensible. And there's a strong institutional interest in maintaining reputation, standing, and goodwill before the courts, particularly the Supreme Court. So one obvious kind of fundamental question is whether to, for example, confess error in ongoing litigation where the prior administration took a legal position in the courts below, and now you're on appeal or perhaps in the Supreme Court, and the question is whether to confess error, whether the executive branch, the Solicitor General, for example, should expressly tell the court that the basic legal position of the executive branch has changed and the prior position in the view of the new administration was wrong. That is a big deal, confessing error. And kind of as an indication that it's viewed as a big deal institutionally is that there's a tradition in the Justice Department that the Solicitor General needs to approve a decision to confess error in litigation, you know, even if you're talking about in the lower courts. And similarly, there's a real reluctance when you're talking about the Supreme Court for the Solicitor General to take a position in a brief that's 180 degrees contrary to a previous legal position staked out by the United States in briefs filed with the court in previous cases. Now, obviously, there's no hard and fast rule against changing position, and it has happened historically. I mean, one example is the Bob Jones case, where the issue was the availability of a tax exemption for a religious university that was alleged to discriminate for religious purposes on the basis of race. And the Carter administration took the view that the tax exemption, that it had the authority, and in fact the law required that the tax exemption be denied the university. The new Reagan administration came in and switched position and actually said it had no authority to deny the tax-exempt status. And the Reagan administration lost that decision in the Supreme Court. What happened was the Reagan administration declined to defend the Fourth Circuit decision, and on the grounds that the IRS lacked the authority to revoke the university's tax exemption, the Supreme Court appointed an amicus to defend the Fourth Circuit's decision, and then the Supreme Court affirmed that decision, essentially ruling against the position of the Reagan administration. But that's a rare occurrence, and I think that what often happens in these cases is that the new administration Solicitor General figures out a way to try to split the baby, if you will, and harmonize positions previously taken with the desired new position, which may be different in outcome, for example, on grounds that circumstances have changed or assumptions that underlay the prior proposition, the prior argument, have proven no longer to hold. So, you know, for example, you may recall the Bush 43 administration struggling over what position to take in the affirmative action cases coming out of Michigan, and whether to stake out a view that diversity was not, there was not a compelling state interest in achieving diversity. And the administration went back and forth over that issue and ultimately decided to take the position that there was a compelling state interest in diversity, but to argue that really to focus on the narrow tailoring and necessity and alternatives that may be available as a way to argue against the affirmative action programs that were at issue. And that was kind of a, you may recall, very messy outcome in those cases and sort of divergent decisions that ended up muddying the waters on affirmative action even to this day. But I think that one proposition that I think generally holds from administration to administration is that the executive branch is going to have an institutional desire to maximize the flexibility of the executive branch in the exercise of executive authority. And what one way to think about that in terms of how you might game out what a new administration is likely to do is to follow the discretion. It's kind of like follow the money, follow the discretion. And what I mean by that is if you think of the world of administrative litigation and the Chevron deference standard where you have prong one and prong two, and prong one of Chevron asks the question, has Congress in the statute at issue, does the plain meaning of the statute decide the case? Has Congress directly addressed the question at issue and decided it one way or the other? That's an issue that the courts will address as a de novo matter. But then if there's ambiguity and if it's not clear that the plain meaning controls the answer to the question, then you reach prong two of Chevron, which is a matter of administrative discretion. Has the agency acted in a reasonable way, interpreted the statute in a way that's reasonable within the sort of range of potential reasonable interpretations? And I think one way to think about kind of changing the ship of state in terms of a new long-term durable policy direction is that I think you're more likely to see those changes occur in the exercise of administrative discretion coming out of the agencies in terms of a different policy approach that's explained through rulemaking, for example, based on either a record or based on a new explanation that's reasonable and defensible for a new policy, more likely as an approach than simply changing the fundamental legal position that the government is arguing under, for example, prong one of Chevron, and saying we interpret the statute 180 degrees different and we think we, for example, don't have the authority to take the action that is under challenge that the prior administration took, for example. And I think one of the reasons you're less likely to see, or that's going to be a rarer strategy for the government, is that there are real downsides to taking a firm opposite position on what the plain meaning of a statute is and what it requires or permits, and then losing on that issue in court. I mean, an example of that is the Bob Jones case. Another example is the Massachusetts versus EPA, which arose in Bush 43, where the Bush administration EPA took the view that it had no authority to issue to regulate greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act on the theory that the plain meaning of the definition of an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act did not include carbon dioxide. That was a conclusion that the EPA reached in the Bush administration. That, of course, was challenged by a number of states, including Massachusetts, and went up to the Supreme Court. And the Bush administration argued that, and the Supreme Court disagreed and rejected that argument, held that carbon dioxide was an air pollutant under the plain meaning of the definition. That then required, they sent it back to the EPA, and it then required the EPA to go through administrative process to address whether to issue rules and what rules to issue, et cetera. And of course, now we're in the Obama, we've come through the Obama administration where they've used that authority to great excess, I think, in some cases being struck down, for example, in the UARG case. And, you know, in retrospect, you can see, I think, that the Bush administration probably would have been better served in terms of the long-term pursuit of the policy goals that it had in mind of not trying to regulate greenhouse gases elaborately through the executive branch, but rather leaving that those decisions more to Congress. If the Bush administration had recognized discretion and then had approached the issue through an exercise of administrative discretion in terms of what kind of very limited program to consider. Similar issues arise, and, you know, there are a number of cases that are pending in the courts right now where you could imagine a new administration trying to take the opposite position as a matter of sort of the plain application of the statute, like the challenge to the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, which has been briefed and argued before the en banc D.C. Circuit. The Department of Labor fiduciary duty rule, which has also been briefed and argued on summary judgment before the district court in Texas. I mean, I think what you're likely to see is the administration wait to see what the courts say on those issues and take a – and rather than trying to come into court or trying to argue to a court, perhaps on appeal or what have you, that the prior administration had no authority to do what it was doing, that its interpretation of the statutes was clearly wrong – I think you can expect the administration instead to go back to the administrative process and announce an intent to completely redo its approach to those rules and to do it in a way that has a rulemaking record that explains why, as a policy matter, in the exercise of its discretion, it's going to change the regulatory approach entirely from what the Obama administration did. And a decision like that is much more likely, I think, to be upheld in the courts, assuming — this is all assuming — the Chevron deference survives. Maybe Justice Gorsuch will collaborate with Justice Thomas to try to do away with Chevron deference. We shall see. But as long as the deference for administrative interpretations of complicated statutes survives, I think what you'll see is the executive branch hanging its hat on an exercise of discretion at the administrative level rather than attempting to make some fundamental break from the past in terms of a legal, black and white legal argument or interpretation made to court that might get shot down by the court. And if it gets shot down by the court, then that just delays further the ability of the new administration to kind of come out in a different way as a substantive regulatory matter. So I guess with that, I'll pause and ask Will or Nate if either of you have any comments or questions on what I've offered, and then we'll be happy to take questions from the audience. Thank you.
Yeah, I think questions would be great. I think that covered it really well.
Okay, very good. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign, and you will be placed in the audience queue. One announcement before we go to questions. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, the 9th, at 2 p.m. That call will discuss President Trump's recent one-in, two-out executive order. And that call will feature Professor Susan Dudley, who's the director at George Washington University Regulatory Studies Center, and Jitender Kolai, who is the director in public sector practice at Deloitte Consulting. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. Looks like we have two questions waiting right now. Let's go to the first question of the day.
Hi, this is Josh Lashman. Do you think that any OLC opinions issued by the Obama administration will be simply withdrawn? Specifically, I'm asking about the DAPA memo issued in November 2014. Vox leaked some draft opinion from the White House saying that they were going to actually stop honoring it. But do you think it will ever happen that OLC will formally repudiate the 2014 DAPA opinion?
Well, this is Steve. I used to head up the Office of Legal Counsel, so I'm not, you know, I'm familiar with that opinion and its details. I think it's probably, as I understand it, based on a very broad, kind of aggressive theory of prosecutorial discretion that's kind of a blanket prosecutorial exercise of prosecutorial discretion rather than kind of case by case, which is traditional. So I have serious doubts about the correctness of that kind of interpretation of prosecutorial discretion. However, as with the Solicitor General's approach to positions taken, legal positions taken in the court, there is an institutional inertia in the Office of Legal Counsel against simply reflexively repudiating prior decisions. There's a kind of a soft form of stare decisis, certainly not like Casey. It's not like they're inviolate. And it is the case, as I well know, it is the case that prior OLC opinions are from time to time repudiated. Typically, and the better practice, in my view, is that they are repudiated through a new opinion that is a fresh review of the issue and a lengthy, in-depth analysis, rigorous analysis of the legal question, and a sort of respectful explanation for why the prior opinion, in the view of the current office, does not hold up and should not and does not reflect the views of the office. But again, that's something of a big deal that would happen. And you can imagine the executive branch not being thrilled about the idea of kind of reflexively concluding that it does not have authority, flexibility in circumstances like that involving, the president's authority under the immigration laws or DHS authority. So there might be institutional reasons why you don't necessarily want to come out with a new opinion that says, oh, sorry, we actually don't have the flexibility that the office previously thought. So what you might see instead is simply the president and the secretary of DHS announcing a new policy position based on an exercise of prosecutorial discretion that, you know, as a policy matter is much more narrow and confined to certain circumstances. And that wouldn't require the office to repudiate the prior opinion. It simply would involve an announcement of a new, more narrow use of discretion and authority. So that's an example of how you might see a new administration approach it in a way that doesn't involve kind of, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater in terms of repudiating a prior legal position.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question.
Okay, we have two callers waiting to ask a question currently in the queue. If you'd like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, I appreciated the discussion of the difference between the more discretionary policy changes versus the black and white legal changes. I was curious what the typical mechanisms would be for each of those. So, for example, if an administration wanted to just say, we are, you know, on a black and white legal basis saying we didn't have authority under the statute to do this, would the most common approach for them to do that be like a consent decree and settlement, or does it totally depend on the procedural posture of the case? And can you talk a little bit about some of the mechanisms through which the executive could do that? And then on the second, more discretionary policy approach, would the typical mechanism just be to ask the court, please hold this in abeyance because we're reconsidering this rule and may issue a new one? Or are there other mechanisms that are typical in that regard as well?
Yeah, I can try to take a shot at this.
Why don't you go ahead,
one.
Will? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Those are great questions. As your question noted, I think there are several inputs for each of these, and the combination of them could lead you to unique places. So the first question is certainly, what posture is the case in? Are you in the district court? Are you in the court of appeals? Which side of the V are you on? All of those questions. And the second and probably more dominant question is, what is the source of the underlying position? If it's a litigating position on a statute like, say, Section 2, where you don't have an independent agency involved, I think there's probably more flexibility to do something immediately, subject to the constraints that Steve identified in terms of altering your substantive position and the kinds of things that went on in the Bob Jones case. If it's a rule, and often it is going to be a rule, or at least an agency decision, the form the agency decision took will play a large role in what has to happen to alter that position. So if there's a rule, the agency is going to have to follow all the steps the APA requires to revoke a rule, and if they fail to do so, that itself could lead to an APA challenge against the agency. If it's more informal, an agency letter opinion, an informal advisory approach, I think you can sort of mirror the process that you landed you into that position going the other way. But I think the wise approach would be, as Steve identified earlier, to take your time and to get it right. And the faster you do it, if you try to turn this big ship around too quickly, you could run into a problem both through legal challenges to your change in position, or more immediately, having a court have a real problem with what you're doing, and giving interveners a broader chance to step in and assert the position in the government's place. Now, that obviously is not quite the same thing as having the United States in the case, but it still doesn't quite solve the problem. So, like I said, there's a lot of permutations here, so it's hard to pinpoint one, but I think the rulemaking ones are the ones that are going to take longer and less abruptly, and the core statutory litigating positions like the Voting Rights Act can be done perhaps through an abeyance and then filing a new brief if the DOJ is willing to take a big step and alter its position.
Okay, Steve, anything else on that last call?
Nope, I agree.
Okay, very good. We have one caller currently waiting in the queue. If you'd like to join the queue and ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Let's go to the next question.
Hi. I was wondering, how much discretion do you think that the Solicitor General's office has when the United States is participating as amicus? And do you have any examples when they've either withdrawn or changed their position in pending litigation when they participated as amicus?
Well, I'll offer a thought on that, and Will probably has further views. But any time the United States, the Solicitor General's office, files a brief in the Supreme Court and takes a position on a question of law, there's an institutional interest in, you know, maintaining respect for the office, for the positions of the United States, and in the relationship between that office and the court. And so it's, even if it's an amicus brief that the Solicitor General is filing for the United States, if the consideration is to stake out a position of law in that brief that is different from previous positions the Solicitor General has taken in prior briefs of any kind filed in the Supreme Court, that's not a decision that's going to be taken lightly. And usually there's going to be an institutional regard for how do you explain that to the court? How do you justify it? How do you explain it? And it's just not something – it happens. It definitely happens. But it's not going to be something that is – or shouldn't be something that's quick and reflexive. And so I just think that's the point I was trying to make. I do think that in cases where the United States has participated as an amicus as opposed to defending an action of the federal government or taking an enforcement action and being a party in the case, there likely is going to be more flexibility in explaining the context, the changing circumstances, why the current administration is taking a view that's different from maybe what was taken by a prior administration in an amicus brief. So I do think there's a little bit less the threshold is a little lower when you're talking about if the position has been addressed in amicus briefs as opposed to where the government is involved as a party.
I agree with all that. I think that's exactly right.
Okay, if you'd like to ask a question of today's experts, Steve Bradbury or Will Consovoy, please enter star then the pound sign to join the queue. Let's go to our next question.
I assume that inside the voting rights section, there's going to be a lot of resistance to from the attorneys who are currently in the section to dropping Section 2 cases and dropping challenges to voter ID laws. How is that handled? Is there going to be an entire new set of attorneys in the voting rights section, or do you think that the attorneys that are currently there are going to switch 180 degrees without institutional resistance?
Thanks for the question. I can sort of take the first half of that, Steve, certainly, and maybe you can give an insight into maybe having been in the department, what happened in terms of staffing, if you have insight there. In terms of resistance, I suspect there will be, certainly based on published reports. And I was part of the litigation team for Shelby County. There was obviously the queer people at Department of Justice felt very strongly about the validity and utility of Section 5, and they feel equally strongly about Section 2. And they believe they have an institutional interest in broadly construing and forcefully enforcing those statutes. But at the end of the day, the leadership, you know, is the political leadership of the department, and I would hope and expect that people would respect the decisions made by their supervisors, and you know, do their duty as agents of the government. But Steve, maybe you have some further insight into what people will do if they are disappointed in the course that is being taken.
Yeah, well, we've seen some press speculation and maybe not so much speculation about the war between the career staffs in some agencies and departments and the new Trump administration on certain policy changes, certain issues. And these things tend to happen more just by the nature of things in a conservative Republican administration that is taking a fundamentally different approach on policy questions involving, for example, civil rights or the environment and enforcement posture in those cases. But at the end of the day, I agree very much with Will that the career staffs in these litigating sections of the Justice Department are professional, and they are unlikely to resign en masse and leave in large numbers their career civil service positions. They may grouse. They may talk out of school. You may see drafts of things, as we've seen being leaked to the press from time to time. But for the most part, the career litigators in these sections are professional. They understand there's going to be a significant change in policy and approach. It's happened before. They've lived through it before, for the most part, and they adjust accordingly. What often doesn't get reported is that there's a large portion of the docket from administration to administration that does not fundamentally change in terms of enforcement actions and enforcement policies from, you know, Democratic to Republican administrations and vice versa. And so there's still a lot of work to do, a lot of cases to build, and so many of them will keep their heads down and, you know, work professionally pursuing the, you know, enforcement of the law. But these tensions are natural, and it's part of the system we have where the leadership changes when a new president comes in. You know, other countries like Australia, to a certain extent the UK, the departments and agencies of their executive branches tend to be to really be directed by senior career staff that stay in place regardless of a change in government. And we have a very different system. It's not a lot of positions that turn over. It's not a lot of positions that are political, but they are the controlling positions. They do set the policy. And these professional staffs in the departments and agencies understand that because they have lived through it. The flip side is, for many of them, the kind of sheer euphoria when a new Democratic administration like the Obama administration comes into power. But they take the bitter with the sweet.
Okay, let's go to our next question.
Yes, this is Hillary. So my question is on this black-white legal settlement versus discretionary policy decision-making. What does an administration – I think I understand you to say that for an administration to come in and take a 180-degree on the legality that was of a position that was previously argued by the Solicitor General is – tricky and difficult. But what do you do if an administration comes in, as is the case with the Clean Power Plan, the petitioners in the states opposed to it, their position is that EPA acted unlawfully, completely outside the statute, contrary to longstanding interpretation. So if you go the softer policy discretion role, Don't you leave these questions open for another administration in the future and to come back and pick up where the Obama administration left off? So I guess my question is, if you are this administration and you've declared absolute opposition to the legality of the rule, what do you do?
Yeah, well, one fundamental variable in that particular case is that the case has been fully briefed and argued now before the en banc D.C. Circuit, and a decision could come down any day from the D.C. Circuit. If the D.C. Circuit comes down with a decision, and let's say the D.C. Circuit agrees with the challengers that the EPA had no authority to craft this plan that essentially forces the states to do a sort of credit swapping program across state borders. I mean, it's pretty – anybody familiar with the Clean Power Plan knows that they've taken a little-used provision in the statute and constructed on that foundation this massive new program that forces states to engage in this kind of trading of essentially credits to force the construction of non-fossil fuel power plants. It's pretty ambitious and extraordinary. And there's a great force to the argument that it exceeds the EPA's statutory authority. But what if the DC, if the DC Circuit concludes it does exceed the EPA's authority, then of course the new administration is in the best position, assuming it completely, as I believe, disagrees with the regulatory approach. It'll just start over, either with no new rule at all or a completely different approach to the issues. On the other hand, if the D.C. Circuit comes down with a decision that upholds the authority of the EPA to interpret the statute in the way it has interpreted it, is the new administration going to try to join the challengers in a petition to the Supreme Court and put a lot of energy and force into trying to argue that, no, we don't have this authority? What if the Supreme Court agrees with the D.C. Circuit or allows the D.C. Circuit decision to stand? What I'm suggesting is while they might take that position in court, they are probably better served in the long run and more likely to go back to the drawing board at the EPA and announce a fundamentally different approach to applying the statute. And what they may do in that new rulemaking is explain why they have serious doubts about the viability of the prior interpretation, but more importantly, the wisdom of it and the implications of it, and why, for any number of reasons as a policy matter, it's not a correct approach, while not conceding that the prior interpretation was correct. I suppose an alternative might be to try to go to the court and get the court to hold the case in abeyance, telling the court that the EPA is going to now takes a different approach and is going to redo the statute, the regulation, or undo the regulation, et cetera. I haven't heard word that there's consideration of doing that. I don't know if others have or will, if you know. But typically litigation has a momentum of its own, and there are parties involved that want to get a decision from the court. And there's no guarantee that the court will hold things in abeyance. So I think in any event, the new administration is well advised to have its EPA move forward with a new regulatory action.
I agree with all of that. Just to underline the point, this is a strategic judgment the administration would need to make, and it doesn't seem to me to be a particularly hard call to go through the agency process to not only not have the first time you're raising a new position be before the Supreme Court in a 180-degree reversal, but also to get the benefit of the APA and doctrines like Chevron give you when you exercise authority through the rulemaking process, as opposed to when you change your position in a litigating posture. The court has been all over the place in terms of what kind of deference it will give to the administration when it expresses its views through a brief. They have given deference, and sometimes they haven't. I would think there'd be much more certainty, as Steve said, if you start all over at the agency, even if it complicates the litigation to some degree, although I think all that can be managed.
Okay, very good, gentlemen. We are moving through a lot of questions. Currently, we have one question waiting in the queue. If you'd like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. Let's go to our next question.
I have three questions, if I may. First of all, what do we know about the incoming Solicitor General? Second of all, have we seen any shifts from the new administration yet on the transgender student case, GG versus Gloucester County? And thirdly, have we seen any other position changes from the new administration yet on other cases currently pending at the Supreme Court?
I'm happy to talk about the second one and a little bit, but the third, I don't have any insight on what's going on with the Solicitor General's office other than what's been published recently. And obviously the SG will have a lot on his or her plate when that office is filled. In terms of the transgender bathroom case, no, the administration got an extension to file its brief. So we will be seeing presumably a brief from the Solicitor General's office on that case. It is one where I think people are looking to see whether the position changes. That is also a case in which new leadership at the agency, Department of Education, and the other agencies involved in this issue may impact the ongoing litigation through actions they take along the lines we were just talking about on clean power. And, of course, the posture of the case in the Supreme Court may affect the range of options the administration has, given that, as a technical matter, the time for supporting petitioners has passed, although, and I don't have any examples to back this up, my gut tells me that if the administration came in to say it was changing its position and the agencies were taking a fresh approach, I would be surprised if they were penalized for having done so at a time when they ought to be supporting the respondent. In terms of other cases, I haven't seen anything come in from the office yet that has changed positions in an ongoing case. I noted the lower court litigation in voter ID. I think Steve noted the fiduciary rule as two areas where we may be seeing that, you know, sooner rather than later. But I haven't seen any other ones. Steve, perhaps you have some other examples.
No, I don't. I don't. And I think there's a lot of people waiting with bated breath on the bathroom gender identity interpretation case, Gloucester County, and that issue generally. Of course, Gloucester County only involves a very informal letter interpreting the regulatory exemption, and there are somewhat more formal Dear Colleague letters on that policy, fleshing out that policy, explaining it. The big background question is, what is the new administration going to do on that question of whether gender identity equates to sex for purposes of the bathroom exemption? And I'm not aware of other cases yet where we can distinctly say that the new administration has taken a different position in the Supreme Court. They do have, political principal deputy in the SG's office now, Noel Francisco. So they definitely have control over the SG, the SG's office, and the positions taken by the office. So I'm sure we will begin to see with great interest how they are explaining differences that they're going to be staking out in some key cases.
Okay, that was our last question in the queue. I will issue a final call for questions. If you'd like to ask a question of our experts, please enter star, then the pound sign. Gentlemen, looks like we've certainly covered all the questions. Any final comments or thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with before we conclude?
Not for me. I felt like we covered it pretty well. Appreciate everybody taking the time to join us today.
I appreciate everybody. Oh, I appreciate all the very interesting questions. And thank you, Nate, for what I think is a pretty good discussion.
Certainly. It's our pleasure. It was great to have you both with us. I think our first call on legal options for the new administration series was a success. And just a reminder to our audience to be looking for emails regarding future calls within that series. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Will and Steve for joining us. We welcome listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.